Hello, this is The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. The intersection of what, you may ask? The intersection of politics and culture. I've been away for a while, haven't been doing this podcast for a minute or so, but I'm really glad to be doing it once more. Issue number one is the obvious one, and of course, I try not to talk too much about the President of the United States, but how can you not help it when there are impeachment hearings going on in the House of Representatives? We're, of course, talking about Donald Trump on the grill. Public impeachment hearings are the agenda of the House, and everybody in D.C. seems to have chosen up sides. Just in case you've forgotten exactly why this is all taking place, it's about the Ukraine and the president's alleged efforts to dig up dirt on his principal rival, Joe Biden, and his son, Hunter. Central question, did Donald Trump threaten to withhold aid to the Ukraine if that country's president refused to start an investigation of the Bidens? This is the core and central issue. Leaked testimony from previous House hearings would seem to indicate the answer to that question is yes. Now, what you are starting to hear and see among Trump supporters, and I'm talking about now Trump supporters in the media, is the idea that this entire proceeding is a sham, that Donald Trump did nothing wrong, that Donald Trump has not actually done what several people have already testified he has. Now, that's a difficult one to try and sell, a difficult one to try and swallow, but that is precisely what they are trying to do. They are slinging accusations at congressional Democrats, saying impeachment proceedings are little more than a witch hunt, and they are invoking the classic line that you've heard in playgrounds since you were a kid. I know you are, but what am I? What a defense that is. Regardless, the outcome of all this seems to be, at least at this point, entirely predictable. That is, the House will vote along party lines, by and large, to impeach this president, while the Senate won't come close to the two-thirds majority needed to convict Trump and remove him from office. So logical people might ask themselves, why bother with all this if the result is so predictable? Why even pay any attention? Why bother having hearings at all if the outcome is prearranged, or predestined, I guess is a better term. And the bottom line is, all this is happening because next year there's a presidential election. Next year, both the House and the Senate, probably the Senate more than the House, will be in play. And it's not just a result that either harms or helps Donald Trump. If the public buys the witch hunt mantra the GOP is promoting, it will doom any chance the Democrats have of retaking the Senate. If the public believes that Trump committed impeachable offenses while in office, it could be curtains for his staunchest defenders on Capitol Hill. You know, the Meadows, the Nunezes, even by his silence, Mitch McConnell. So you're looking at the possibility not just of Donald Trump either going up or going down, because he's up for re-election, but many of his staunchest defenders, many people who are in representing blood-red constituencies, if they buy into the narrative that the Democrats and the witnesses thus far have told, then it is entirely possible that some of these people will lose their seats. And that's what the Democrats are hoping. They're hoping that they can flip the Senate into Democratic hands, elect a Democratic president, and then begin the painful process of dismantling a lot of what Donald Trump has put together, including an immigration policy that appears to have been constructed by a known xenophobe. I'm talking about Stephen Miller. That's another discussion for another day, because Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has called on him to be evicted from the Trump ambit because of some emails that go back a few years that expose Miller's, perhaps under the radar, xenophobia and racism. But that's another discussion for another day. Now, Democrats seem to be, thus far, winning the messaging battle. However, Don't bet the store that that's going to last forever. The right wing, particularly the right wing media, the Fox Newses of the world, have begun pushing back on the narrative that Trump has done wrong in office. And by the way, done wrong, I'm talking about done wrong enough to be impeached. They are pushing back furiously on this narrative. They are saying this whole thing is a show. Sean Hannity has said that he believes that they ought to shut this down immediately. Now, I don't know why he thinks anybody's going to pay the slightest bit of attention to him. But what they have said is that the first two witnesses who have appeared before the House in considering all this were underwhelming at best. They talk about the fact that what these people have testified to is hearsay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems as if they're falling back on the idea that Donald Trump, if he didn't say it publicly or if he didn't say it directly to any of the witnesses involved, that he has some sort of plausible deniability here. I don't know how you managed to pull that off, given the fact that there are people who listened in on the phone conversation he had with the Ukrainian president. I don't know how you do that. It's like, you know, believe half of what you see and none of what you hear. I don't know. I have no idea how they're going to press this narrative. However, I do know that the narrative has a resonance with Donald Trump's base. Donald Trump's base believes that this is a witch hunt largely orchestrated by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. They hate her guts. I mean, they really hate her guts. Probably more than Trump himself does. And yet, that is a credible narrative to a segment of the population. I have always believed that the whole Donald Trump base thing was wildly overstated, even going back to 2016. Because remember, he didn't win the popular vote in the general election of 2016. He lost by about 3 million votes, no matter what he or his people tell you. So my thing is, quite simply, how big is this base? Have people believed the notion that it has expanded that widely? And I mean that widely, to the point now that people can sit back and say, well, you know, Donald Trump, man, he's got this huge number of people who dote on his every word, who will in fact believe anything this man says. I think there are people in the population that believe that. Do I think it's a majority? God, I hope not. But it is a possibility that the base is larger than the Democrats think it is. And right now, there appears to be nothing that this man can do that will erode that support in his base. The evangelical Christian community, which ought to be considering Donald Trump anathema to their belief system and their moral values, they've managed to find a way to accommodate even Trump's moral excesses, documented moral excesses. I'm talking about a few of the things that he has said out of his own mouth. But they have found a way to mitigate all that. And it's entirely likely that no matter what comes out of this hearing, no matter what comes out of the impeachment vote, it will not move the needle on Trump supporters one bit, not even one little bit. Now, there are times that the Republicans seem to be grasping at straws. This, I think, the first day of the hearings happens to be one of them. However, do not assume that they will not find their footing and feed into this president's persecution complex. And trust me, Donald Trump has a persecution complex. It is a persecution complex long and wide. He has never been able to admit, since he's become president that I know of, any wrongdoing whatsoever, not even any wrong decision-making. He takes credit for things that he should not take credit for, but yet he's got this core army of people who dote on his every word. And the Republican Party, who is now part, parcel, and hostage to Donald Trump and his presidency, are trying at this point to figure out a way to keep him in office and to keep their seats. Because I think people ought to be very clear about this. Politicians generally, Republicans, Democrats, Tories, Whigs, it doesn't matter. Their first priority is their own seat in the Congress, in the state legislatures, wherever they may be serving, and I use the word serving loosely. Their first concern is themselves. And we know Donald Trump's first concern is himself. So they would throw Trump under a bus if they thought that their constituents would not create some sort of backlash that would cost them their jobs. But right now, they think going along with Trump, getting along with Trump, is what their constituents want. We'll see after next year. If 2018 is any indication, maybe they shouldn't be counting their chickens before they hatch. Maybe. But we see a rash, and I mean a rash, of Republican resignations from office. People deciding, I'm not doing this anymore. The latest being Long Island Congressman Peter King, who represents a Republican, at least Republican-leaning, constituency in suburban Long Island. Now, it's entirely possible that seat could flip. A Democrat could theoretically win Peter King's seat, even though he's held on for, decades, perhaps? Now, if this continues, if people decide to abandon ship in Congress, rather than stand with Donald Trump, rather than sit back and make excuses for a man for whom there is, no excuse, then you may see a wholesale shift. You may see a shift that will change the fiber of American politics for many, many years to come, assuming that the Democrats know what they're doing. And sometimes, I got to be honest, I'm not always certain they do. They didn't know what they were doing in 2016 when essentially they jobbed Bernie Sanders. I'm not saying they jobbed him out of the nomination, but they jobbed him. Are they going to job people this time around? Are they going to job the progressives this time around? We're going to get into that, but I want to find out from you first, who wins this ideological steel cage death match between Democrats and Republicans on the issue of impeachment? Does the Republican message resonate? Does it resonate with enough people to render this Democratic-led probe neutral, neutered, not relevant? Makes no difference to people. I don't know. We're going to see how that turns out because it will affect the 2020 election. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that it's going to affect next year and beyond, well beyond. When we come back, first, there was Michael Bloomberg, who, you know, every time I think of this man, I think of a term that a columnist used, a Latina columnist used to describe him, El Bloombito. And there's also Deval Patrick. Do either one of these folks who are now seriously considering running for president, do either one of them have a shot? We'll take that up momentarily. Thank you so much for listening to The Intersection.
You're listening to The Intersection of Politics and Culture with Mark Riley.
Welcome back to The Intersection of Politics and Culture. So, another day, it looks like we have two more people who want to run for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States. it looks like both former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick will throw their hats in the ring. Why, you might ask, so late? It appears that Democrats are worried sick that the current slate of candidates cannot beat Donald Trump. Now, how they come to that conclusion is utterly beyond me, mainly because most of them do well against Trump in head-to-head polling. But, of course, polls can be wrong. Witness 2016 as an example. Now, I'm a more the merrier type of guy when it comes to people running for public office. If you want to run, if you've got the requisite number of signatures or whatever to get on the ballot, fine, run. Why not? Let anyone who wants to run do so, and let the voters sort it out, rather than have either the Democratic Party or others, the Brahmins, the people that make the decisions at the top, decide for us who's doing what. Or, for example, the pollsters or the people that count the dollars, the fundraising. Now, it apparently is not the Democratic Party way. The more the merrier is not the way the Democrats function. Again, I would refer you to 2016. Better for them to go by polls and fundraising. As I've said before in previous podcasts, the media plays a role, and not a great role, in this, I don't want to call it a charade, but this circus, this sort of gong show among candidates and which ones are viable and which ones are not. Every fundraising deadline day, we breathlessly equate the ability to raise money with the ability to capture the nomination. So now we're going to see two new entrants in the sweepstakes, if it turns out both of them decide to run. For Mike Bloomberg, fundraising means literally nothing. He's got his own money, some $52 billion worth, and he can make the measure of his viability his polling numbers without having to really worry about fundraising. He reportedly edged closer to running because of Biden's supposed vulnerability. Deval Patrick has less clear motives. He's a good friend of former President Barack Obama. His downside is that he's worked with Bain Capital, which is, pardon the pun, the bane of many Democrats. Either way, recent polling says people in crucial swing states prefer a moderate candidate to a progressive candidate. Maybe that's why so many people are coming late to the race, at least two people coming late to the race, who are people who Deval Patrick is saying that they can bring together the progressives and the moderates. Mike Bloomberg makes no such claim. Mike Bloomberg is a moderate, and he, I believe, thinks he knows better how the country can run, and most importantly, who can beat Donald Trump. But one of the things I find interesting about all this polling and all of the Sturm und Drang around the Democratic Party candidates is that they almost always center around white demographic groups, whether it's whites with high incomes, whites with less than a college education, whites, whites, whites. And of course, Donald Trump's base is also largely white. So what you end up having is this sort of circular firing squad with people judging and predicting what certain groups of whites are going to do. And it's almost as though people of color are kind of sort of on the sideline in all this. And it doesn't really, to me, make a great deal of sense, as the people of color and the segment of people of color with high incomes, with less than a college education, almost never get reported on. Largely because, I think, the media believes they're already in one corner or another. Starting out, Joe Biden had, for example, a sizable majority of the black vote. I don't know if he does anymore, and they certainly don't break it down. They kind of lump it all together in minorities. I don't know if Elizabeth Warren has made any headway there, Bernie Sanders, etc. Bernie Sanders at least understands that in order for him to be successful, he does need to bring people of color into the fold. And this is something I've had discussions with people about for better than a decade, almost two decades. And that is the weakness in the progressive cause when it comes to opening itself up organically to people of color. When I say organically, I'm talking about bringing people of color into the equation in leadership positions. Bernie Sanders understands this. I think Elizabeth Warren probably does too. But for a lot of people of color, particularly black people, the progressive movement is a white movement, well-educated white people. Now, that may not be true. Certainly, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a woman of color, and some of the other folks in Congress who have ascended to congressional seats over the last couple of years, these are exceptions to the rule. But I think that many, many black people look at the progressive cause and say, well, where are we in all this? And it's going to take, and I've said this before as well, it's going to take some serious effort on the part of the progressive community to reach out to people of color. It was just the other day when it got cold in New York City, 5,000 housing authority tenants, people living in public housing, were without power for the better part of half a day. How do you speak to those folks and tell them that progressives can see to it that does not happen again? I'm not quite sure that progressives have found the magic bullet just yet. I think progressives should not be afraid to stand up for what we believe in. I think sometimes we are. You know, when people start screaming about how much is Medicare for All going to cost? Well, and I think that several people have made this point, how much does what we have cost compared to Medicare for All? Is Medicare for All going to bankrupt the Republic? No, absolutely not. But you would think, listening to people talk, that Medicare for All is going to take everybody in the country, take away their insurance, and in some instances, create a worse situation for them, healthcare-wise, than what they're currently experiencing, which, of course, is nonsense. So progressives do need to, in fact, stand up for what they believe in. Mike Bloomberg is not afraid to stand up for what he believes in. There's no reason why progressives can't match that. Now, all that having been said, I don't think Mike Bloomberg was the worst mayor, certainly, of New York City in my lifetime. There are certain things he did that I really, really liked. I actually sat and broke bread with this man, and we've agreed to disagree on a lot of issues, like stop and frisk, which was a deal breaker for a number of black people during Mike Bloomberg's tenure as mayor, and even now is a deal breaker for people like Charles Blow at the New York Times, who says anybody who would vote for Mike Bloomberg in a primary cannot be a friend of mine. Now, I don't necessarily pick my friends based on their political beliefs. Maybe I'm unique in that regard. But Bloomberg does have that to answer for. He steadfastly defended stop and frisk. And for those of you who don't know what that means, it means that police officers aggressively go out and stop people. In the main, I believe somewhere between 75 and 85% people of color, and end up questioning them, frisking them. Most of them are innocent, but it's done anyway. And it created, I think, for many people in black communities across New York City, a reign of terror and certainly a great deal of distrust with police. And, you know, the logic was in the old days that if you didn't have stop and frisk, that the crime rate would go up. Well, stop and frisk is essentially no more, and the crime rate continues to go down. So that whole thing about going back to the bad old days turned out to be mythology. Of course, people who promoted it don't say so, but it turned out to be complete and utter mythology. I believe that at a point, progressives are going to have to stand up to those whose mantra is that progressives can't win. Progressives cannot, even in the face of the 2018 elections, there are people who believe that progressives absolutely cannot win, not win the presidency. I think that's nonsense. It's actually untried unless you go back to the 1920s, and it was a very different group of progressives even back then. I think that establishment Democrats, and by the way, establishment Democrats have the ears and the purse strings of those who fund, quote, liberal, unquote, politics in America. It's not the progressives by and large, even though Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have large numbers of donors who are generally just ordinary, everyday folks. But the fact of the matter is there is a Democratic Party establishment. And that Democratic Party establishment is scared to death right now, and it's been scared to death before. It was scared to death when Bill Clinton ended up capturing the Democratic nomination. We all know how long ago that was. The fact is they're afraid of unknowns. They're afraid of people that they don't think have a chance of winning. And among the current crop, and you got a gigantic crop of people, a large number of people, including Bloomberg and Patrick, if they both throw their hats in the ring, who theoretically could win. And by the way, when Bloomberg says, well, Joe Biden, I'm not sure he can win, and Deval Patrick says, I can bring the moderates and the progressives together, it ignores some moderate candidates who are still in the race. Amy Klobuchar is still in the race, is a confirmed and self-admitted moderate. So I don't know what they think they are actually doing. Bloomberg could, for example, pour money into the campaign of a moderate, whether it's Biden, Klobuchar, or whomever, and maybe create a difference. Although it is sad to me to contemplate that one way you make a difference is by money. That is something that sooner or later America and the American body politic are going to have to confront. It's time that it ends, but it hasn't ended yet, so money does drive politics. And of course, money sees to it that if somebody calls you up on the phone who's been a major donor to your campaign, they get their phone calls returned. That's why they play the game the way they do. Should Mike Bloomberg run? I believe he should if he wants to. I believe Deval Patrick should run if he wants to. I don't know that they're going to do really well with the Democratic Party base. I don't know that their late entry to the race won't be seen as a cynical ploy to try and derail someone else's candidacy, which maybe it is. But be that as it may, let them run. The more the merrier. I hope their motives are pure. When we come back, we're going to talk about vaping. How dangerous is it? Should vaping and e-cigarettes be banned? Why do we know so little, and I mean pitifully little, about what is making people sick and what's killing people with vaping? Thanks so much for being with us. This is The Intersection.
Join the conversation at Mark Riley Media on Facebook.
Welcome back to The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. And now for our final segment, we take up something that is partly cultural, largely political, and potentially deadly. We're talking about vaping and e-cigarettes. In the wake of spiraling e-cigarette use by young people and sickness and deaths attributed to vaping, politicians and health officials have reacted by doing what they normally do, doing what they do best. Many cities and states across the country are seeking to ban e-flavored cigarettes to keep them out of the hands of young people. Now, there is also a call for a federal ban on flavored e-cigarettes. There's one problem, however, with all this, and that is that they're trying to close the barn door after the horses run the derby. E-cigarettes are now part of the fabric of American life. Like it or not, if you want to start trying to figure out how to curb vaping use and e-cigarette use, you have to start with the notion that, quite frankly, people did not take the time or make the effort to see to it that it was properly understood and regulated from the very beginning. When manufacturers touted these products as viable stop smoking options, there was little scientific evidence either pro or con. That has allowed lobbyists for e-cigarette makers to say, with some credibility, that it does in fact help people stop tobacco cigarette smoking. Now that vaping has been directly linked to illnesses and at least 40 deaths, health officials don't seem to know what ingredient in e-cigarettes is causing the sickness. That would seem to be the top priority. Even before you ban it, understand it. Understand what it is that's making people sick. And you're talking about thousands of people turning up in emergency rooms across the country and 40 people dying, but they don't know from what. How in the world is that possible? How is it that you have this thing that people are using? And make no mistake about this. I don't believe young people should be vaping, using e-cigarettes, or should manufacturers be aiming their products at that vulnerable group of young people. It shouldn't happen. And I don't know whether flavored e-cigarettes are directly aimed at children or not. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. It appears as though young people take to them. Now, there are ways to deal with this beyond simply banning and then creating a burgeoning black market among young people and adults for e-cigarettes. One thing you can do is treat it more like tobacco. Now, you go in most stores these days and you find that cigarettes are not out there prominently displayed. Yet, you go to the same stores and e-cigarettes are in fact prominently displayed. Regulate how they're displayed, regulate very tightly who can buy them, who can use them, and you may have gone some distance in trying to make this use start to decline, if that's your purpose. You certainly don't want people getting sick, young people or adults. Now, I know a couple of people, not many, but a couple, who say that e-cigarettes did, in fact, cut down on or made them stop smoking regular cigarettes. And that's a good thing. Now, the problem is, of course, that e-cigarettes, like tobacco products, contain nicotine. So are you just robbing Peter to pay Paul if you're using e-cigarettes as a substitute and it's got the same measure of nicotine, in some cases more, than tobacco products? It's an interesting question and one that really ought to be answered. But the main thing that has not yet been answered that demands an answer is what in the world is causing people to get sick? They don't know. There was some talk about a particular derivative, I believe, of vitamin E as being a potential cause, but they haven't narrowed it down. They haven't nailed it yet. And certainly, there are reasons to be concerned about youth vaping, okay? No one wants to see that, even at the level it is now. But tighter regulations can deal with that. It can be changed. The way it's marketed, the way it's used, it can be changed. In other words, adults who think vaping does work in helping them quit cigarettes can still access the product legally. You start banning it, and suddenly you create a black market for adults. And that doesn't make any sense. It's not logical. Now, if it's not known what's making people sick, how can you stop the use? How can you properly even regulate the use? And what do you do about the black market that will certainly spring up if you ban e-cigarettes? There will, as it turns out now, there's already a black market. There are black markets not just for e-cigarettes, but for e-cigarettes that contain various levels of THC, in other words, the active ingredient in marijuana. Most people, and I think a lot of young people, can certainly point to instances where they can go someplace and get whatever kind of e-cigarettes they want, whether it be flavored with weed or whatever. And it may well be, again, we don't know yet, but it may well be that that is the crux of the problem, that people are using these things without knowing what's in them. That is something that must be arrested as quickly as possible. Now, understand that the e-cigarette industry, the vaping industry, is a powerful one. Even though e-cigarettes haven't been around since the dawn of time, there are lobbying groups, very effective lobbying groups, that are trying their best to keep these products unregulated, keep these products pretty much in the same situation that they're in now. Are they right? Are they wrong? Should vaping be banned? Should there be a federal ban on vaping or e-flavored cigarettes? I don't know this whole flavored e-cigarettes business. I don't know the extent to which. I know that a lot of people, the torchbearers for banning, say that it is the flavored e-cigarettes that lure young people. Maybe they're right, but then again, maybe they're not. I don't know whether that's true. I do know this. You have to get a handle on what it is that's killing people. When it comes to this sort of thing, 40 people are 40 people too many when it comes to this vaping. I won't call it an epidemic, but certainly the use is spiraling. More and more people are using it. You can see it on the street. You know, it's funny, you walk down the street and, you know, in the old days, you would see people with tobacco cigarettes and you see a slight stream of smoke or whatever. Now you see vaping, it looks like a fog has rolled in on an entire block. That's how easy it is to inhale this stuff and to get whatever benefit people feel they get from it. Because people do not use products just for the hell of it. They don't use products largely because they are somehow addicted to it. Although you could make the case that vaping could become addictive. Again, not enough data. You can make steps and take steps to make the public aware of what the downside or downsides of vaping are. That's not impossible to do. And folks, before more people die, we need to make the effort. Thank you so much for listening. The executive producer of The Intersection is Ms. Kim Jack Riley. And until we meet again, please stay well. But you know that I just couldn't stay. Gotta go to the place where the people are happy and healthy. And I know that I won't have much money. But I'll live in a house by the sea, and I'll laugh and I'll sing, and I'll have everything that I need. And you know I won't let you forget me, 'cause I'll write to you every Wednesday, and you'll picture the scene as I show you the places I've been. I'll send you postcard from Brighton, and I hope you can read what I'm writing, 'cause there's so much to say but not enough space. I wish you were here, but I know you'll come visit someday.